Psalm 14. And as you can see, the hard part of talking about the Psalms is that there's no logical progression. We're jumping from one mood to another without reason. But each Psalm, some might appeal to you, you might want to go back to some of them, etc. So Psalm 14, as I see it, and check it for yourself, is an impassioned reflection on the folly and the corruption of those who do not acknowledge God, do not sense the sacred in things, but treat everything practically. What you see is what you've got. So they don't see a tree, really. They don't see a bird. They don't see a storm. They don't see a child. They don't see you. They don't see themselves. They live this kind of so-called practical life, which is pretty superficial, isn't it? If you don't see the sacred, what on earth are you seeing? Well, that's what he's saying. What a folly and empty and shallow and it is. And thank God we've got artists and we've got mums and dads, and life surely opens everyone to the mystery, whatever name we give the mystery. We use the word God, that's as good as any. No better than many, but that it'll do for a word. But sensing that there's a sacredness at the heart of everything. As Teilhard de Chardin put it beautifully, God is the heart and the beyond of everything. That to me is so perfect. If you don't get to the heart, you're not reaching where God is. And as you get to the heart, you get this immense mystery that's all enveloping your own heart or other people's heart. And thanks to Jesus, we know the heart is actually love. So that's a wonderful thing too. So this is an impassioned reflection on the folly and corruption of those who do not acknowledge God, and a statement of faith that Yahweh is on the side of the oppressed. There's a lesson in that too. We must take sides. I know I first learnt that at the university when I was chaplain there. Because I grew up, my teaching was, you know, Aristotle, Thomas Aquinas and everything, and to be, you know, in medio start virtus, and how you can't be extreme and you've got to be balanced and you've got to listen to everybody, you know, all that stuff, and it's got to be reasonable and all that. Well, if you pursue that to the end, you actually will do nothing. Because the Vietnam War was going on at the time, and the people in favour of the Vietnam War, as I would see, my own opinion is the people of in favour of the war in Iraq, to me are as blind, because I can see what they... I don't know why they can't see that they're creating terrorism. But anyhow, so, okay, so I'm against that, okay? But the people against the Vietnam War at the university, every left-wing ratbag in the world was on that side. You know, and they would be in favour of every damn thing that I would see as madness. Do you get me? So what do I do? Be reasonable and sit in the office and say my prayers and kind of generally say, oh yes, but, oh yes, but, oh yes, but, oh yes, but. I learnt that actually you have to take sides on these issues. You have to take sides, and you'll always be siding with people you don't agree with, because it's a big jumble of things. On Aboriginal welfare, on whatever it is, because you can't just sit in the middle and one insight into a complex reality is more true than another. So somewhere, that's what I learned anyhow. Wish I did it more often. But I learned that you must take sides and then live with the fact that you're walking along the road demonstrated with people about whom you have nearly no agreement except on the issue that you're demonstrating on. And that's enough. Right or wrong, that's how I came to see. So Yahweh is on the side of the oppressed. Yahweh loves the oppressor. Yahweh loves the oppressed. But in the matter of oppression, he's on the side of the oppressed. That's what they came to see. Just as Jesus took sides and he said to the Pharisees, stop, take the burden, you know, off people. He loved them, and if they stopped, he'd be all over them, of course. But he really stood on this side and said no to the other. He stood on the side of the woman in adultery. He's not in favour of adultery. He even said to her, don't sin again. But he was there down with her. He wasn't standing with the people with stones in their hands. You get what I mean? So here it is. That's a basic truth. If we fail, again introducing the psalm, if we fail to acknowledge the true God, we'll create our own. And that's another thing that people don't seem to realise. If I'm not willing to search and wonder and ponder about the true God, don't worry, I will be creating my own. It might be me, it might be a political party, it might be finance, it might be economics, it might be winning, it might be, God knows what it'll be, you know, but I haven't found anyone who hasn't got a God, and your God is that which you actually worship. It might be yourself. When you make big decisions, what's the criterion you use to make them? That's your God. So, it's much better to go through the struggle we're going through. Israel, by the way, means he who struggles with God, so we're not on an easy path. But why wouldn't we want to be on a real path, difficult as it is, than be on one that's just phony and going nowhere? So, if we fail to acknowledge the true God, we'll create our own. In this case of our psalm, it's the untrammeled power exercised by those who show no concern for the poor. Verse 7, we'll see, is a plea that Yahweh will restore his people, and it's composed, it would seem, by someone writing from exile. Is it someone writing from exile after the destruction of Samaria in 721, perhaps? Is it someone in exile from Jerusalem, the destruction or the capture of Jerusalem in 598? Is it someone from a later exile? We don't know. But the person seems to be exiled as a result of some catastrophe. Psalm 14, this doesn't interest you yet, but it's almost identical with Psalm 53. This happens rarely, once or twice, I think. You've got the psalm repeated somewhere else in the book of Psalms. It's almost identical. Verses 5 and 6 are somewhat different, and where Psalm 14 has Yahweh, Psalm 53 has God, Elohim. So you might be dealing with a northern and a southern version. Or the psalm may have come from the northern Israel, and when it came into the temple, they substituted Yahweh for Elohim. I don't know. But there's been an adaption somewhere along the line. Well, with that introduction, which you'll need to check to see if it's valid, I'll now take you through the psalm. Fools say in their hearts, there's no God. That's pretty abrupt. That's where he's starting. Fools say in their heart, there's no God. Some other references that say much the same thing. Psalm 10, verse 4 and 13 reads, in the pride of their countenance, the wicked say, God will not seek it out. All their thoughts are, there's no God. Why do the wicked renounce God and say in their hearts, you will not call us to account? And that Psalm 10, which we've already done, alerts us to the fact that that first statement, fools say in their heart they're no God, is not atheism. It's not we're not suggesting that anyone in those days, they may have existed, but they're not academic abstract thinkers who say there isn't any God, like theoretically. What they're really saying is it's irrelevant to our lives. There's no God for all practical purposes, whether there be a God or not, who cares? But there's no God who's going to judge me, there's no God who's influencing the world, you know, it's irrelevant to the way we live. That's a practical agnosticism, really, that they're saying about it. What he's saying is you're foolish if you don't take into consideration that there's a divine presence and influence and love and judgment in your life. A little bit more, Psalm 94. They say Yahweh doesn't see, the God of Jacob doesn't perceive. That's more the point. Do what you like. Don't let people tell you that God worries about it. It's irrelevant. So get on with it. Do what suits you. Job, you say, what does God know? You're following my logic? That's what he's really talking about here, not academic atheism. His anger doesn't punish, He doesn't greatly heed transgression. So don't let people stop you doing what you feel like doing in the name of God. Okay, so back to our psalm. These are the people who say there's no God. Second part of verse 1 and the following. They're corrupt, he says. They perpetuate dreadful deeds. There's no one who does good. Perpetrate. Thank you. Thank you, John. They perpetrate dreadful deeds. There's no one who does good. Yahweh looks down from heaven. Now that's obviously an image you've got in the Old Testament. Do you remember where they build the Tower of Babel? And God says in heaven, and it's playful, he says, I wonder what's going on. So God comes down on a cloud and looks over and says, they're building a big tower trying to get up to heaven. I better do something about this. So it's just playful poetry, children. It's lovely, not literal for heaven's sake. So similarly here, God's looking down from heaven. Well, that's an image, and it's good. On Adam's descendants, to see if there's a wise person anywhere. To see if there's a Noah anywhere. That's the point of the story of Noah, of course. The power of one. If there's anyone who let grace into this crazy world. Is there anyone who's seeking God and he's checking? And thank God he found Mary of Nazareth and he found, hopefully, you know what I mean? He finds millions of people. No, they've all gone astray, he says, the psalmist. He's pretty bleak. They're all depraved. There's no one who does good. No, not one. Well, that's pretty bleak. And that's how he sees the world. And sometimes you might even see it that way yourselves. There's not a glimmer of light anywhere. Nobody seems to be listening, etc. That's the mood of this psalm. And I go take you back to the book of Genesis in this lovely folk story, chapter 6 of Genesis, just before the flood, which of course is a mythical flood. Yahweh saw that the wickedness of humankind was great in the earth, and that every inclination of the thoughts of their hearts was only evil continually. And Yahweh was sorry that he made Adam, humankind, and it grieved him to his heart. Yahweh regretted that he'd ever done it. He'd done all this wonderful cosmic thing to create man as the climax of it all beautifully, and he saw that it was very good, and then something comes in called sin, and the story of the Cain and Abel, you know it all. But it's a story about my life and your life too. That's what it's about. A story about life and all the warring that was going on and the violence and then the sexual abuse and stuff that was going on in their world, that's described in that thing, the dreadful kind of mess. And God eventually comes to the point where he says, well, look, it's just hopeless. I've got to get rid of it all. So he decides to flood the earth, let the firmament collapse and all the water above come down and let all the water from below come up and it'll all go back to chaos. Chapter 1, verse 1 of Genesis. But thank God, says the author, God was going to do this, but he looked around and he found one person, one, who was just Noah. So he couldn't destroy it. And the point of the story is, why don't you be that one? So he found one, so he said, oh, you get it. And the ark, of course, is not a boat. And if anyone's looking for a boat, they're wasting their time. It's a temple. It's the shape of a Jebusite temple. And so the temple is there rising above the waters, and all life is in it, and so it's the source of all light and all love, and when the flood recedes, everything beautiful comes out of that temple, of the sacred, of the one who's in the heart of God and stays there. Everything beautiful comes into the Vatican through John the 23rd, or John Paul II, please God too, but or everything beautiful comes into Calcutta through Mother Teresa of Calcutta, or everything beautiful, etc. So it's there. Yeah, that's the feeling of that. Similarly, a reflection on it as well from Romans, an interesting chapter. It's chapter 3, verses 10 to 17, and you'll see Paul quotes this exact psalm in verses 10 to 12, and I've just shown you the rest of it, the rest of 13 to 17, where he keeps quoting other psalms, like he's piling text upon text to make the same point, how of ourselves the world's in a mess and we need Jesus. So I'll read you Paul now, Romans 3:10 right through to 17, and you can see the references there. There's no one who's righteous, not even one. There's no one who has understanding. There's no one who seeks God. All have turned aside. Together they've become worthless. There's no one who shows kindness, not even one. And that's another version of the translation from the Greek of our psalm. Then he goes on, quoting other psalms. Their throats are open graves. They use their tongues to deceive. Does that happen? The venom of vipers is under their lips. Their mouths are full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Ruin and misery are in their paths, and the way of peace they haven't known. There's no fear of God before their eyes. Here's Paul giving a very similar feeling when he looked at his world. But he goes on to say, thanks be to God through Jesus Christ. Love entered this, and there's something we can do, and we don't have to be paralyzed by it. What we need is people to live the way Jesus lived, and the world could be transformed, and that's our mission. And the psalm now goes on. Just two more before I ask your comment. Verse 4. Those evildoers, says our psalmist, do they know nothing? Do they know nothing? And in Psalm 82, a similar cry. They have neither knowledge nor understanding. They walk around in darkness, says the psalmist in another place. And Isaiah 44 reads, they don't know, they don't comprehend. Their eyes are shut so that they can't see. Their minds as well so that they can't understand. Don't want to understand, so they close their mind down. And here's the key point of the psalm. This is why he says they can't see. Verse 4, the second part. They devour my people as if they were eating bread. Look at Sudan, maybe. That's a big example of it. Maybe look at the Gaza. We'll see another example of it. And we could go on and on and on. We don't want to exclude our own country and what's happening in certain areas and what's happening to the really poor and so on and so on and so on. So they devour my people for their profits and their bottom lines, etc., as if they were eating bread, and they do not call upon Yahweh. They ignore Yahweh, meaning not just ignore God, but ignore Yahweh, who is the God of redemption, the God of liberating God, the God of Exodus, the God of the journey, the God of the promised land, the God of history. The God whom we should remember. They're not remembering all that. They're just going in for the quick quid now. And here's Micah, similarly, making similar statements. You who hate the good and love evil, who tear the skin off my people and the flesh off their bones, who eat the flesh of my people and flay their skin off them, break their bones in pieces and chop them up like meat in a kettle, like flesh in a cauldron. He's not wasting words, is he? But you've got to say it as it is. And now the psalm concludes. Well then, verse 5, Psalm 14. Well then, they will have to tremble for God stands with the just. You may thwart the plans of the poor, but Yahweh is their refuge. Oh, that deliverance for Israel would come from Zion. That's the temple, eh? Where God is. Oh, that deliverance would come from there. We're still longing to see it. When Yahweh restores the fortunes of his people, Jacob will rejoice and Israel will be glad.